This episode is brought to you by Fetch. Fetch is a kennel alternative right here in Denver, not a traditional doggy daycare or boarding school. They offer one-on-one private pet care for all kinds of pets, both furry and non-furry. And their employees are experienced, insured, bonded, and background checked, so you can rest easy knowing your pet is in good hands. Basically, they know pets. I used to watch a Burmese mountain dog named Sven, who was just like walking a polar bear. It was insane. Fetch offers pet sitting, dog walking, pet taxi, medication administration, and more. And he hated going on walks. I could like walk him around the block and then he was like, he just liked to lay in the bathtub. So if you're looking for high quality pet care you can trust, check out Fetch at northdenver.fetchpetcare.com. That's northdenver.fetchpetcare.com.
Today on CityCast Denver, state lawmakers put forth a radical proposal to reform our public transit operator, RTD, a couple of weeks ago. But after pushback, including on this show, they backed down. So where does the long-awaited RTD reform debate go from here? With less than 3 weeks left in the legislative session, I'm sitting down with one of the reform bill's co-sponsors, Meg Froelich of Englewood, to talk about why she's not done trying to get the buses to show up on time. Today is Wednesday, April 24th. I'm Paul Caroli, in for Bree Davies, and here's what Denver's talking about. Representative Meg Froelich, welcome to CityCast Denver.
Thanks for having me.
So where did this idea to reform RTD come from?
The big question, right? So I'm on Transportation Legislative Review Committee. That's a standing interim committee. And so every year RTD comes in and the other transit agencies come in, and we also hear from riders and we have a lot of public comment. There was appetite on that committee to really do everything we can to make RTDs and the other transit agencies as successful as possible. Now, I'll say right off the top, we're a blue state with a red budget. So in terms of funding options, our hands are more than tied.
Cheap is the optimal word.
Right. We were able to do some things that we felt were supportive, you know, our ozone free fare. And this summer we are exploring, or a bill came out to explore youth fares. So that's one piece of it. Then the other piece of it I think that's probably equally significant is what's going on in the building in terms of land use and housing.
You're talking about the State House?
The State House, yes. Mm-hmm. So at the Capitol, we are doing things like transit-oriented communities and lifting parking minimums and doing everything we can to increase housing stock and work towards attainability and affordability in the housing space to address our housing crisis. And of course, another key element is all that we're doing to address climate change. We're actively trying to get folks out of their cars, to reduce vehicle miles traveled, to achieve our greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals. So the idea of transit reform is statewide.
So it sounds to me like there's a lot of moving pieces that all kind of fit into one big puzzle. And we've heard, you know, this from Democratic leaders like yourself. We've also heard a lot about this from Governor Polis, who seems to be really enthusiastic about this densification push in cities and making our transit systems more efficient. But a lot of the critics pointed out that it seems like a big part of this reform push has been Governor Polis's like personal priority of building this front range passenger rail that he's been so excited about. Do you think that's a fair criticism of the reform proposal?
I understand that is, I would say it's fair to discuss it. I don't know whether it is actually a negative thing. I think we need front range passenger rail. I think we need to figure out how that's going to coordinate with our transit agencies, how that's going to help us meet our climate change goals, how it's going to help us meet our housing goals. Of course, on front range passenger rail, we're able to leverage huge federal dollars. So I think we need to put all the pieces in place to do that.
Clearly, there's an opportunity there.
There's an opportunity there. You know, I've been describing this, as you did, as sort of a lot of puzzle pieces coming together, specifically on our the bills that came out of our ozone interim committee. Transit is a piece of that to achieve our climate goals. The most controversial piece, the governance piece, comes from a couple different places as well.
Let me explain that for folks who maybe haven't been following this. The governance piece you're referring to, that's part of this bill that you all put forth to reform RTD, and it would have changed the way we elect the board of directors, and it would have shrunk the board. And so it would have made some of the seats at large. They would have been voted by a whole district of people rather than smaller districts, which is how it's voted now. And that really seemed to be the big sticking point for a lot of, especially Denver community leaders. I talked to former Speaker of the House, Terrence Carroll, a couple of weeks ago about this, and he was really, really, really critical about this. So is that why this proposal fell apart this session? Is that particular issue?
Well, first of all, it hasn't fallen apart yet.
I mean, you peeled the governance piece out of the bill.
Yes. So the governance piece will be a process now. But, you know, I also spoke to former Speaker Carroll, and we talked about this piece. So, yes, the original proposal, I think there was a look at nationwide, what are the comparable transit agencies and what are their governance structures? So we are unique in a 15-member elected board. There are bigger boards, but they're appointed. But we're definitely on the big side, and we are the only one with that many elected. There's a couple things that, on the surface, a 15-member board, by its very nature, and I think Speaker Carroll will agree with this, and you should have him back on, because we've been talking a lot about these concepts, that a board that large, it has a tougher time being nimble and responsive. And what ends up happening at RTD is really the executive board does most of the work. So the original proposal wanted to go to sort of a popular national model, which is all appointed. The legislators carrying the bill didn't want that. So we've been going back and forth on what would be a workable number. The national model would put you somewhere between 7 to 9 folks. And the other was a sense that the districts lead to provincialism and less of a district-wide viewpoint. That balanced with how difficult it is to run an at-large race, and especially one that big. We definitely felt that criticism. We explored a bunch of different iterations. The other interesting part of the conversation, and again, I say interesting because I think all these conversations are valuable. What is the role of appointments on these boards? And what has the 15-member board over 44 years delivered in terms of diversity and representation? So over 15 board seats and 44 years, there have been 5 Latinos served, period, the end, with 2 of those being appointed. We have our first wheelchair user. This is an incredibly important voice in this space. He's appointed. Mm-hmm. So is there a way to achieve greater representation if you have appointments, but they have strict criteria? Could there be a union seat, for example, which I think would be a really important voice in the room? Some of the members of our affinity caucuses, our Latino caucus and our Black caucus, are interested in that concept. Is this a way to assure representation?
So it sounds like you're still interested in some governance changes, potentially. I know you've talked about being still open to keeping this conversation about reforming RTD going.
Yes.
Tell me about that long term. Like, what are the problems you think are worth solving, other than these issues about representation on the board itself?
Yes. I think there's a desire to professionalize the board, which is not to say that the people serving now are not professionalized, but that this position takes a lot of time. And so we would like to see it paid better, and we would like to see people really able to afford to spend the time that it needs to be on this board. So that leads us down a path of pay increases. And I also think on that front, that's tough to do across 15 seats, but maybe 70 seats that are paid, you know, 70 grand or 90 grand or whatever it ends up being, again, part of the discussion. And that discussion comes also from wanting folks to run for these seats. So currently on the board, there are four seats where nobody was running. Nobody stepped up to run. Now, luckily, four people, you know, entered the race and got enough write-in votes to be elected. But the other huge percentage of the board ran unopposed. That's just a piece in terms of what would the board look like if it was a competitive seat that paid well, that was fewer people. And maybe, I don't know, as we said, this conversation is going to continue, maybe a couple appointments in there to make sure that certain voices are in that room and certain voices are part of the conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that seems like almost an existential issue for RTD, though. I feel like I feel like we're talking a lot about governance, but we're not talking about the issues that like really matter to people who ride RTD, like frequency of service, like how widespread the bus lines are. And there's real conflicts here between the more suburban areas and the urban areas. Like how are these reform efforts, these governance changes supposed to actually affect real people's lives in Denver?
You're absolutely right. So part of the puzzle pieces is a potential increased funding stream, which I think is incredibly important.
More money. That's huge. I hadn't heard that before.
Yes. It's Vegas rules. So we can just say potential funding stream.
Wait, what does that mean? Are we gambling this money?
I wish I could say more. It's contingent upon a lot of things. There's a lot of things coming down to the wire.
What are you talking about? Give me some insight here.
It all will be revealed. Let's just say that it's really important as we try to meet these goals of co-locating housing by transit, that we have this actually reliable and frequent transit, right? It's not going to work if there is no way to actually commute or to get from A to B.
Exactly. See, now we're talking here, because this is the thing that other critics of the governor have been talking about for years when it comes to RTD, which is he has a lot of ideas about transit. He talks a lot about the Front Range passenger rail. But when it comes to actually funding RTD, there's never any money for it. And that's what it's going to take to increase service and make a difference for people. So you're talking about maybe there is some talk about a new funding stream, more state money for RTD. That's huge. Tell me.
Yes.
What's happening?
But I also think that, as you pointed out, there's conflict or challenges regarding the suburban entities who pay into RTD but receive, you know, somewhere between 10 and 30 cents on the dollar of their investment, and include potential transit-oriented communities that don't have the transit. The other part, I mean, this conversation, I'm grateful for it, even though we've sort of been pelted by Rotten Tomatoes by proposing this particular bill and the way it's sort of evolved.
So you're talking about like hiring bus drivers has been a challenge for RTD since the pandemic, probably. And that just costs money.
They've been actually exemplary on training and hiring, and they've met some goals on that. They're having a real retention problem. And it's not safe for a lot of drivers, and it's not safe for passengers at times. We want to solve that without armed police force increased presence. So I really think that has to do with frequency. A big part of that is frequency on the route. If you're waiting half an hour for a bus, that's very different than if you're waiting 10 minutes. And if that bus comes every 10 minutes and then it doesn't come, and then you're waiting 20 minutes, that's less safe for passengers. So you're absolutely right, Paul. It's how are we serving riders? And where is the need, and is the need being met? And I know in my community, I have light rail stations that have very sparse service. I have the C line that was canceled. I have no east-west bus routes in my house district. I have one, I think, on Hamden. But hard for people to get from A to B. We look at something like youth fares. Is it even possible for a student to get to work from school, which is one of the goals of something like youth fairs, to get to an activity or get to after-school work? Are there even bus routes that run from the school or stop anywhere near the school? And I think, again, that's been an ongoing criticism of RTD, that we understand that they're balancing a lot of things, but are they, and I hate to use the word nimble, but because I've used it like 20 times today, but are they nimble and are they able to respond to some variances in their strict scheduling and routes? And the reason that it comes back down to governance is because maybe the reason that they aren't responding is because the board is significantly balkanized and only addressing the issues within their own district.
Right. We got 15 directors. They're each representing their own little, you know, their own little area of the metro area. And a lot of them are suburban, so they don't have the same interests as the directors that are representing the urban areas. So we've got this kind of stalemate here. And then to top it all off, no money from the state, which might be changing. I just heard this. News just in. Let's talk about the big picture here. So you mentioned this other bill that the governor has been really excited about, which would be creating a new transit-oriented development program, like new funding for cities across the state. But conditioning it on highway funding? Is that it? Help me understand how these pieces fit together.
Yes. So the big land use bill last year, 213, that really was delivered to us in kind of a top-down manner and pretty spectacularly exploded, contained a lot of pieces that were trying to address these goals of addressing housing and climate change. That's sort of been split up like an atom, and there are probably a dozen bills in that space dealing with local government and land use and how we can both carrot and stick local governments to get on board with climate change and get on board with developing housing. So one of the key pieces of that is the bill that's 1313, which is transit-oriented communities. Again, mostly carrots of we'll really want you to develop these spaces around your light rail stations. We'll help you identify them. We'll help you cobble together the different ways in which you can access funding. And then the stick currently in the bill, and we'll see if it remains after it goes through the Senate. The stick is, if you want to be on board with this and help us achieve these goals, that's great. And if you don't, that's fine too. But then you're seeing as you're not being a team player, then maybe you don't need as much transportation funding as seeing as you think you're all as well in your part of the world. So that's probably the most controversial piece of that bill.
What do you think are the chances that that bill goes through?
I think it will land at the governor's desk. I don't know what components will remain. It's a pretty aggressive approach. And this is always a dance in the building between local control and state action. And we feel in this case on land use in general that it is a matter of statewide concern to address our climate and housing goals. The governor in general is much more of a carrot kind of guy, especially on, you know, the environment where we tend as a legislature to push a lot more on the sticks and penalties and accountability and fines, and the governor's much more inclined to do rulemaking and incentives and things like that. The other bill that was part of 213 and is an important concept is the lifting parking minimums. Mm. We're not saying that an apartment doesn't get a parking spot, but they maybe don't get two, or they mm-hmm. maybe get one, but they pay extra for it. And that works if you have a walkable community and you can walk to transit. It doesn't work if you can't. And it doesn't work if your transit is one bus every hour, the way it is in a lot of suburban places. And we're lucky that the voters approved 1, 2, 3. So there's some money going into affordable housing, attainable housing. But the reason that we're in this conversation is because it's part of the mix and we want to row in the same direction. I don't know if this bill will make it to the finish line. I don't know if this funding stream will manifest. It won't go if the funding stream doesn't manifest. And it won't go if community is completely and utterly opposed to a board composition conversation.
And you're talking about the RTD reform bill. You don't think it'll go unless there's funding attached?
Yes.
Interesting. Well, Representative Froelich, you mentioned that last year the governor's big omnibus densification package crashed and burned. Around this time, at the very end of the session, here we are again. What percentage of the individual pieces that you all have been working on of that big package do you think are going to make it to the finish line this year?
The bulk of them, the bulk of the pieces of 213 addressing climate change and housing goals and trying to bring them into alignment. That's often how things go. You have to, sometimes you don't make it in the first go round. For instance, Just Cause for Eviction failed its first year. It takes a couple swings sometimes.
Two steps forward, one step back.
I think we learned a lesson that we needed to shop this around a lot more. All three bill sponsors, actually, myself included, served on our city council. And so we were really focused on local governments and what local governments wanted to see have happen. And that's only a sliver of the folks who have an interest in this. We did have a lot of conversations with riders, and there is a rider reform group that we were trying to sort of actually tailor the bill to meet their core asks. But I think the message to us was that we didn't talk to enough people and we didn't talk to the right or the certainly certain groups that we didn't talk to that we should have.
Well, we'll see how those conversations develop over the next couple of weeks. We'll see what gets passed in the end. And Representative Meg Froelich, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. If you enjoyed the show, why not take a minute to tell your RTD director about us? Rate the show wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to our morning newsletter, Hey Denver, and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more news from around the city. See you then.
Well, we always do 80% of the work in the last, 3 weeks. So it's kind of hideous.